thank you very much, Pamela, and thank you very much for the invitation to speak. Can everybody hear me? Am I projecting?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me if I start to dip. Okay, so I thought I'd start by taking you back to the autumn of 1930, when Wells Coates, who's a little bit older than 35 in this image, was sort of thinking about his practice and where he might be going. And this is after something of a shaky start to his career. In 1930, his career is beginning to take off, but just a year previously, things had been looking a little bit doubtful. This is the first professional commission that Coates has. It's for a silk shop selling fabrics and some clothing in Silver Street in Cambridge for a manufacturing firm called Crusade. It was the first store, and it was meant to be one of several. And this was Coates' first major commission, and he was optimistic, as you might imagine. And the store was very well received. Arthur Tristan Edwards, a very well-respected architecture critic and architect of the day, described it as particularly elegant. And the Cambridge Preservation Society wrote to the head of Crusade to compliment them on making a contribution to the architecture of a street which up until that date had been rather grim and dowdy. So it all looked terribly positive when the store opened. But then crisis struck. His boss, Alec Walker, head of Crusade, founder of Crusade, had a nervous breakdown. And in the midst of his pain and angst, he decided to sack everybody he'd brought on board to set up the company and set up a new vision of art-designed, affordable silks to a kind of middle-class public. He sacked Coates, and he also sacked Tom Heron, who'd been the main kind of person in charge of getting the silks designed and brought to the store. So what had seemed so promising suddenly seemed doubtful. But as is so often the case, what seemed a fundamental blow turned into a blessing. Heron was galvanised by the sacking. After some doubtful reflections, he decided no, this was a sign, and that perhaps this was the moment for him to emulate Crusade and set up his own company, which would manufacture silks and clothing and sell them from well-designed retail environments. He knew what Coates had done for Crusade already, and he decided that Coates was going to be his sort of second in command. And he appoints Coates really as a jack of all trades. Coates is supposed to be a sort of manager. He's supposed to kind of oversee ordering and all that kind of stuff as well. But in particular, Heron gives him the task of designing what I guess we'd now call the corporate identity of the chain of stores that will become Cresta. And he asks Coates to design a number of projects. First of all, the factory where the silks will be printed and manufactured. That's at Welling Garden City. And then a series of retail stores, mostly in London and the South Coast, and nearly all in locations beginning with B, which is rather satisfying. So Brompton Road, Brighton, Bournemouth, Baker Street, and so on and so forth. And this is the first Cresta store, which was opened in 1930, and it was opposite Harrods. The site's no longer there. It's where there's a large block of flats just opposite Harrods, and it was subsequently moved a little bit further along the road to a corner site. And again, alas, there is no vestige of the design anymore. I think I put the Brighton, yes. And he also designed one in East Street, Brighton. Alas, neither there, which opened in 1931. So for someone whose career had really only started with that first store in Cambridge in 1929, I think you can see that already quite a significant evolution has taken place in Coates's design language. Crusade, there's a definite set of ideas being worked through here, and interest in materials like plywood and aluminium, but it's a bit clunky, it doesn't quite hang together, whereas by the time we get to the interior of the Brighton store, there's much more sophisticated synthesis of materials and space, and a real setting for what we have to imagine as the incredibly vibrant fabrics which Cresta were manufacturing, really beautiful blues and reds, yellows, really densely printed textiles. Now, if you know anything about Coates, you'll know that Coates was a deeply thoughtful and very reflective man, very analytical. And he was also a man who was used to communicating his ideas through the written word. Before he becomes an architect, he's been working as a journalist, so he's someone used to writing and working through ideas. And by the time he was beginning work on the Cresta stalls, he started to reflect on how his work had developed in those very first years of his practice. And there's a very interesting letter which he writes to his mother in the course of 1930, where it's almost as though as he's writing the letter, he comes to a realisation of where he's kind of gathered, or the influences which have played upon him in developing this particular aesthetic. And he wrote, and I won't read out the whole quote, you can read it, but I just point out that he sort of says, I come to a realisation as I'm sitting down and working through the commissions that I have, that it's what I was exposed to as a child and as an adolescent. It's that visual sense of the Japanese, their quiet, sober, rather odd term, classical culture. And that, he felt, had given him the senses and perhaps the sensibility to proceed with what he calls his appointed job in the West. And Coates has a very elevated sense of his own mission throughout his life. And as he concludes, it's the Chinese, the Eastern, the Japanese outlook I have had all these years which have enabled him to reach this point of practice. And another thing he also notes in the letter, which I'll come back to, he says, Japanese rooms are quiet, distinguished, really beautiful, and at the same time, livable, convenient, efficient. And it won't surprise you to know that at this point, this is when he and the Pritchards, Molly and Jack, are really starting work on the design that is going to become the Lawn Road Flats. So these ideas are sort of buzzing around in his mind, but I'll talk a little bit more about Lawn Road anon. So this is a letter he writes to his mum in 1930. She's back in Japan. And over the next 2 years, Coates develops this idea of the importance of this so-called Eastern outlook to his works. And this becomes a sort of whole narrative in his talking and in his writing about how the East, which he eventually refines just to the Japanese, had shaped him. And some of this is published and some of this is in more private correspondence. The first kind of public discourse on Japan and architecture, they're not explicitly related to his own work, comes in an article which is published in November 1931 for the Architects Journal. It's actually a pair of articles, one called Materials for Architecture, where he talks about modern materials like plywood and metal, steel, and so on and so forth. And this, where he talks about, it's a sort of potted history of Japanese architecture. And in it, he talks about the sort of different, what he calls the different classes of Japanese architecture. And he concludes that the importance of Japan for architects who might be reading the Architects' Journal in the latter months of 1931 was that it was an inspiration, that there were perhaps principles to be discerned in Japanese architecture which might be relevant to architects like him. It wasn't something certainly to be copied, but something to be inspired by. And he's obviously talking about this with his friends as well. As I'll explain, Coates is in has a very interesting network of friends. These are people who've helped shaped a lot of his thinking during the 1920s, and he's very much part of what is a sort of English avant-garde in the later 20s and the early 1930s. And he's obviously been having lots of conversations with Paul Nash, and Paul Nash is a good friend to him. It's Paul Nash who gets him the commission, or helps him get the commission to design the studios at Broadcasting House, not far from here. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of network of, you know, promoting each other's work. And in a very interesting book that Nash publishes in 1932, which is a series of his articles from various architectural journals, he makes a point of noting the work of Wells Coates. And it's quite clear, as I'll show you in a minute, that he's been listening to some of Coates' stories about his childhood in Japan. He references Coates' early training at the hands of Japanese builders, as you can see. But he also notes the idea of Coates as someone leading the new architecture with a clear conception of what he calls modern principles. And he makes a link between that Japanese experience and a set of values which are necessary if modern-day architecture is going to be reformed, reinvigorated, which is, of course, the task which Nash as a modernist and Coates as a modernist have kind of set themselves. Now, this kind of narrative culminates in a text which Coates writes at the request of the PR department of the BBC. So as the BBC is nearing completion in the summer of 1932, he's contacted by its PR department for an autobiographical outline. Now, being Coates, everybody else who is asked for a biographical outline sends a paragraph which says, you know, my name's Edward Morph, I design buildings, I trained here, and that's what I do. I've also designed this and that. So and Coates writes about a script, an entire several-page discourse on his personal history. And he was he's a great architect, but he does go on an awful lot. I think it comes from writing lots of letters to his family when he's travelling around once he leaves Japan. And in this text, which, as I say, does go on and on and on. Sorry, I thought I'd quoted it. I'll come back to that. He opens this with a very clear kind of declaration of who he is. And he says, I was born in Tokyo, Japan. And then follows this very long disquisition on his life up until pretty much literally the day he was writing the text and sending it off. Now, in that text, and I'm going to kind of refer to it and quote from it as I go through my talk this evening, but also in this text by Nash, this important connection between Coates and Japan is kind of asserted and made, and it's one which, with some elaboration, has really become a commonplace in discussion of Coates's work. Japan is important to an understanding of Coates, and it seems to be understood as integral to his practice as an architect. I don't disagree with that at all, and I want to spend most of my talk this evening kind of tracing the link, using what he says about it as much as possible, seeing this link between his upbringing in Japan and his practice in England from the late 1920s onwards. I do want to unpick and nuance that idea of the centrality of Japan to his work, but I absolutely do believe that Japan is very central to how Coates understands what he does, and indeed how he does it. So just to start by saying, I think that happens in a couple of key ways. Firstly, and most obviously, as many have noted, it can be seen in the formal language of his architecture. A lot of the motifs which Coates uses, particularly in the domestic interiors in the 30s, owe an obvious debt to Japanese domestic architecture. But perhaps more subtly, it's in, as he suggests, the set of design principles that he discerned in Japanese architecture. I think another very important thing for Coates and the kind of persona that he develops as an architect is the sense of distance that being born in Japan gave to him, and also the subsequent moves across the globe that he experiences. I think that sense perhaps of coming to things afresh, coming to things from another place, is important if, as a modernist, you're interested in making it new. I think it's an important impact, and I think it allows Coates to do things which perhaps other architects maybe don't feel quite the freedom to do. At the same time, I think it's also important to note, and Coates himself did, that it wasn't just Japan that made him an architect and allowed him to achieve what he did. Rather, it was a kind of process of synthesis that enabled him to become an architect. And as he wrote in that biography, which gave him the confidence to practice my profession alone, and he located that confidence to what he called a dovetailing of his background of Japanese culture and what he called my early Eastern training, and its synthesis with what he called his Western scientific training. And it was the blending of those two things which I think allowed him to become the remarkable architect that he did. So I want to tell you some of that story this evening. So let's start at the beginning. And I am indebted to Coates' niece, Sylvia, who gave me some of, who allowed me to scan some of these rather embarrassing photographs of Coates as a child. So here he is with his parents. He's in the centre wearing a delightful shirt with three of his sisters. He also has another sister and a brother. And as he says in that biographical statement, I was born in Tokyo, Japan, on 17th of December, 1895. What we know about Coates' childhood is piecemeal. There isn't a huge amount of documentation. We know, and I'm sorry, apologise for this lengthy quotation, we know what he wants us to know about his childhood in Japan. And this is a very typical paragraph by Coates from that BBC text, where he establishes a narrative which will not change for much of his life. It's certainly true that he doesn't go to a traditional school. His siblings will go to a school set up by their parents some 10 years after Coates is born. He certainly was sent away from home when he was about 10 or 11 to live with an English person who taught him, who basically gave him a sort of senior school education. Coates claims that he's taught the art of the brush, he's taught by Japanese architect builders, how to use craftsmen's tools. And my favourite sentence, I attended for 4 years the Central School of Jiu-Jitsu in Tokyo. Who knows if that's true or not. Quite an interesting education. Also in this statement, he tells us that the English tutor to whom he's sent when he's a sort of early adolescent taught him Western subjects, what he calls Western subjects. And it's very interesting he makes this distinction between East and West. And Mr. Gauntlet, who was his tutor, taught him shorthand and typing, always useful, he says, Mr. Gauntlet told him, draftsmanship according to the Western method with set squares and compasses, mechanics and analytical geometry, and so forth. Well, it's hard to know how much of this is fabrication. I think you can probably imagine that I think quite a lot of it is fabricated. Certainly, we know that his parents were missionaries for the Canadian Methodist Church, which I think gives Coates an early training in preaching. He was always one to inculcate and promulgate. Agnes and Harper Coates were people of profound conviction. And really very remarkable. I mean, it's not surprising Coates is a remarkable fellow because his parents were really quite extraordinary. His mother, Agnes Wintermute, came to Japan in the mid-1880s on her own as a missionary and set up the first girls' school, Christian girls' school, in Kofu in Japan on her own, designing the schoolhouse herself. Harper Coates, the Reverend Harper Coates, arrived a little bit later to Kofu, and they marry and will have six children between 1895 and 1906. So she's really remarkable just for having so many children in a relatively short period of time. Both parents have a very genuine interest in Japanese culture. Harper goes on to become professor of comparative religion and philosophy at Aoyama College in Tokyo, and becomes a very respected scholar of Buddhism. Agnes is actually the more interesting of the two, I think. Essentially, completely rejects her Methodism by sort of the 1910s. I don't think she tells her husband for a few years, and kind of, if, as it were, goes native. And really becomes deeply embedded in Japanese culture. And by the 20s and the 30s, she's arguing for the assimilation of Eastern and Western values as a way of moving society forward. Both, as Coates' description of his childhood suggests, are keen for their children to experience Japanese culture, and they spend a lot of time, seem to go on regular visits to Japanese cultural sites, and so on, and so forth. So just a few family pics, just to kind of... So here they are. This is the whole family all together. Coates' brother Wilson becomes a history professor at Rochester College in the States, and his sister Carol becomes a notable poet. Kind of very badly composed photographs, but nevertheless interesting. Lots of going around and sightseeing. This is from 1910. This is a diary he keeps of sort of family holiday going around, and these rather nicely, very tidily written account of the Crown Prince's Palace with attendant drawings and plans. His education, again, it's difficult to know quite what it encompassed. He certainly does, as I've said, get sent away further south in Japan, possibly Okayama, to be educated by this English man called Gauntlet, who is married to a Japanese woman. The rather kind of romantic account that Coates gives in that autobiographical statement may be about kind of rationalising what must have been a very lonely period, separated from his family. I mean, when he's 10, he's sent away, and he doesn't seem to communicate with his family other than by letters. He doesn't seem to go back. Seems a strange thing to do with your children. At the same time, as far as you can work out, he's living in Western-style housing. He's eating Western food, as the Christmas menu for 1908 tells us. And in his correspondence, in diary, little diaries and so forth, which survives, his references are to the Canadian, the colonial community in where he's living, and to the British Empire. They're going to see the new consul and things like that. He does seem to have been thoroughly imbued with Western values and to see Japan through that kind of lens. And certainly his parents raised him in the expectation that in due course he will go back to the West and receive a university education in the Canada from which the family derived their nationality. So that's kind of his childhood. And there isn't a huge amount to tell us much more about what he got up to. What we do know is that in 1913, as he goes on in this sketch, that he leaves Japan with his father to travel around the world on a boat and end up back in North America, where he meets the extended family who live in and around New York, and he's looking dapper in his bow tie at the top back there, and then go to university in Vancouver. So what happens in the kind of 17-year gap between leaving Japan and writing that letter to his mother and becoming a fairly well-known modernist architect? Well, quite a lot. And this is perhaps what he means when he talks about his Western training. So Coates goes back to Vancouver to train to become an engineer. He studies, he matriculates, and enters what's now the University of British Columbia to study mechanical engineering. Very noble profession for the son of Canadian missionaries. He's going to be a good colonial son. And it's just worth noting how kind of future-oriented engineering. I think Coates's experience over the next 10 or so years is very much about things which are modern, things which are new. And that's really reinforced by his volunteering to fight. He joins up in 1917, following discussions with his family, and he initially joins the Canadian Field Artillery. And as he recalled, I learned the excitement and horrors of that other applied science, which is modern war. So mechanical engineering to start with, and then the horrible engineering of war. This is obviously the most mechanised, the most industrialised of wars. And the kind of odd irony, which you can see Coates is on the right-hand side of this image holding a horse. That was his job. He looked after the horses which brought ammunition to the massive artillery weapons at the front. So you have the kind of past and present, almost future of warfare, just encapsulated in that particular job. But he kind of ratchets up the modernity by joining the RAF. He applies to join the Royal Flying Corps towards the end of 1917. The Flying Corps becomes the Royal Air Force in April 1918, and he starts his training in early 1918. And the RAF is in the vanguard of warfare. Flying, bombing, aerial war, is the most modern form of warfare that you could get. And Coates is flying in highly intricate machines which are built around the body of the pilot, built from the newest of materials. This is pilot body frame machine, all kind of blended into one seamless entity flying through the sky, and in this case bringing bombs to the battlefront. And this is something Lance Sieverking, who goes on to become a producer at the BBC and another kind of friend of Coates, writes about in 1922. And I think it's a really interesting article that he talks about what he calls the fundamental effect of flying on the mind. as something which, if you've experienced it, and it's very interesting how many modernist people in the interwar period have some experience as pilots. Talks about how it kind of it transforms your approach to the world. And he talks of a new type of mind emerging as a consequence of people having flown about the sky and being in that upper air. You can't see things the same way if you've flown above the world. He talks about it must, he says, that experience must broaden the mind's own possibilities and charge it with the vital essence which can only be absorbed from startling experience. And I want to suggest that this is something which has a profound effect on Coates's kind of point of view. And indeed, as we can see him here in his standing by his plane, he himself registered this, and he wrote to his sister Lila in 1918, how everything seems different when one can leave the earth every day and play about in the clouds. This is a transformative experience, I think, for Coates. Oops, let's go back. Keep that one there. So he's had this extraordinary experience, but I think a little bit like that sense of Japan kind of nestling in the back of his mind, it perhaps doesn't have an immediate manifestation. So once he's demobbed, once he goes back to Canada, he finishes his degree, graduates with first class honours, which he's quite keen to tell people about, and he wins a scholarship to come and study here in London. He wins a funded research post by the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, which is a new body set up to promote R&D in British industry. So again, something new, something progressive in terms of British industrial culture. And he comes to what is now Queen Mary University of London to do a PhD on what I always forget the title because it's extraordinarily dull. Did I write it down? No, I didn't. Yes, I did. The gases of the diesel engine. All very important. You think diesel engines, transport, all that kind of stuff. And he learns all sorts of very practical things during that course about putting things together. He has to design all the equipment to do his experiments. So again, little bits of things happening in his life, which we can start to see making him an architect. But although he starts his study in a very serious fashion, and it's quite clear from letters that you know he's very studious and he goes to college every day and he's in the lab, he starts to get distracted. And by towards the end of his study, so he comes to London in 1922 and he completes his PhD in 1924, it's quite clear that he started to feel disillusioned by this very materialist world in which he finds himself. And there's quite a number of letters where he corresponds with his brother about philosophy and kind of the meaning of life. And this is very much to do with a new friendship network which he's developing sometime around 1923. And it causes him to go from this very sort of, I mean, not a great photograph, but bow tie, very sort of uptight kind of figure, to someone being sketched by John Banting, who's a very avant-garde painter of the mid to late 20s, this rather louche figure with a sort of piece of grass in his hand and his open neck shirt lolling against some kind of basket work chair. So it's quite a shift between 1923 and 1925. And this very much has to do with a new friend he makes probably towards the end of 23, early 1924. He's a fellow student at Queen Mary's, a geography student who's about to leave and go off and be a bit of a lefty at the LSE. And together they become a sort of team of modern intellectuals deciding to sort of take London by storm and become the most progressive, the most sort of almost romantic modern figures. They're going to reinvent themselves as kind of great modernist intellectuals. So together they kind of embark on a programme of reading modernist literature, listening to modernist music, and in particular hanging out in London's most sort of progressive and bohemian nightclubs. So we're not talking Bright Young Things kind of territory, we're talking even more kind of dark avant-garde environments. And a particularly important place that they frequent is the Cave of Harmony, which was a club established by, among others, the wonderful Elsa Lanchester, who will later play the bride of Frankenstein, which is what she's doing here. This was not her normal garb. She sets up this wonderful club. It's a very ad hoc, very sparse environment called the Cave of Harmony in Cheyne's Mews, just in Gower Street. It's quite a short-lived club, but it's this, what's interesting about it is, first of all, it's this very empty space, as you can see, just a sort of setting for people to mingle and to kind of communicate and share new ideas. It's also a place where she lives, and I think this idea of challenging ideas of domesticity and not living as you're expected is a very important lesson for Coates. And a lot of the people who attend the Cave of Harmony and the other kind of clubs that Bourgeau and Coates are attending, like the 1917 Club, which is a very left-wing club, are full of people who are refusing the norms of contemporary bourgeois society, whether that's in terms of sexuality, domesticity, ideas of what's good culture and what culture might be. He's starting to move in environments where people are saying, let's rethink things, let's change things. And I think that has another very important impact on Coates, that he's mingling with outsiders in Britain, and he himself has that already, that sense of perhaps not being of this place. So he's with people where, in a sense, that's almost a normal experience. But he's still being a scientist. So in 1924 he gets his PhD, and then when he decides he doesn't want to pursue a career as an engineer, he then turns his attention, he decides to become a journalist. And for the next 2 or 3 years, he learns his living writing for papers like the Daily Express, but also working on and off as a secretary, which is how he meets Max Fry, who's another very important mate that he goes around and does kind of cultural things with. Perhaps the kind of real catalyst for Coates to draw an end to those sort of years of peripatetic work is a rather traumatic experience he has during 1926. As a kind of culmination of their lives as modern adventurers, he and Bourgeau decide to go on a kind of mature gap year and declare they're going to live through their senses alone, travelling on their own by hitching rides and so forth through the Canadian Rockies. And they set off in May 1926 and spend some months travelling through the Canadian sort of outlands. And it's during this experience that Bourgeau is killed when he falls off a freight train on which they're riding. And not surprisingly, Coates, who finds his body, has to bury it, go and inform the authorities and so on and so forth, and deal with that. He's deeply traumatised by that experience. And when that's all resolved, he comes back to England and kind of starts afresh. And it's really from that time onward that the architecture begins to start. And the first thing that happens to kind of kickstart that is that he gets married. And he's met this rather remarkable woman called Marion Chamier Grove at the Cave of Harmony before he's gone to the Rockies. And they have a tumultuous, quite tempestuous love affair. Then they split up, he goes to Canada, he comes back, and then they meet by chance and they decide that they're going to get married. And what's also very interesting about his wife is that she too has her own experience of a non-Western upbringing, this time in China, where her father, Frank Grove, was the chief engineer on one of the railways being built. It was the Shanghai Railway. And here I have a wonderful photograph of her all dressed up in Chinese clothes with her ama and her siblings. So again, he's married to someone who again has that kind of detached experience of growing up elsewhere, and then she's sent to England when she's about 10 to go to boarding school. And there's something about boarding schools and modernism as well, which is another research area, which is another story, but I think it's quite an important one. They marry, and it's when Coates redesigns his bachelor bedsit into a marital home that there comes this idea that perhaps what he's been is messing around is really been a prelude to finding his vocation, which is in architecture. So here's Marion, painted by Banting, and she describes the moments where Coates decides to stop being a journalist and devote himself to a career as an architect. And as she says, she writes to, this is in a letter to her mother-in-law, it was fitting up our flat that gave Wells the idea of exploiting this very perfect taste in colour and design, as well as his knowledge of carpentry and his technical knowledge in this way. And she describes the flat, which alas no longer exists. We only know it through descriptions, but it's a wonderful description. The place tinkles with glass and reverberates with aluminium on Wells's startling design. All we know is that Coates seems to have panelled the walls with aluminium plymax, which is plywood faced with a very thin sheet of aluminium. He bought very plain cord fabric for curtains, with Banting painting a line on it. That's all we know, but I think we can imagine a very sparse, plain setting for what was a very modern marriage. And it has the effect of impressing many within his friendship network, and it's through that network that he begins to get more commissions, and it's through that friendship network that he meets Alec Walker and gets the commission for Crusade, which is where I started. So to think a little bit more about the interiors that he's designing and this approach that he develops towards them. Also in that biographical statement is a paraphrase from a book that he took with him when he went on the journey through the Canadian Rockies. And this is a phrase which in various forms he will use again and again in his writings. And I quote, "The man whose eyes have been trained in the East will only rarely want to open them in the West." This comes from a book called The Travel Diary of a Philosopher, which was published in 1926 and charted this German sort of philosopher's account of a journey he makes through India, China, and Japan, and the kind of difference between the Western culture, the Western way of seeing, and what he encounters in Japan. So it's perhaps this book which first plants that seeds in Coates' mind of the difference that one cultural setting might bring in your outlook compared with another. And through this Westerner's view of Japan, Coates, I think, discerns some important principles. And I think key to these are the idea of overloading, of disliking paraphernalia, of disliking stuff, How rarely, says Kaesling, is a European aware that a room exists for the man and not vice versa, that he and not the curtain or the picture is to be given his best possible setting. So with some paraphrasing again, we might say here, in terms of Crusade and later with Cresta, perhaps the idea here is that if we substitute silk and frocks for the man, Coates is very interested in thinking about spaces as settings, environments which enable things to work most effectively. And that's something he feels that he can't have learned in the West, because we have this barbaric habit of overloading, and I'll show you an image which kind of epitomises what that means in a minute. So to that, those sort of principles, Coates then, I think, begins to develop a certain vocabulary of motifs, mostly to do with using shoji screens and devices like the tokonoma, particular sort of set pieces on which you linger within an interior. But he also, and I think, again, if we look at these interiors and the use of materials, he's using the most modern of materials. I think that comes from this Western scientific training, this experience of flying an aeroplane during the First World War, which is made from plywood and aluminium. And in Coates' mind, what he's doing is synthesising these Japanese notions, this Japanese outlook, with into modern terms, applicable, he says, to Western conditions. So I thought I'd show you some of the interiors where I think some of these ideas are coming into play. And the first of these is really quite, again, one which no longer exists. It's now an NCP car park on the Bayswater Road. It's a rather sad decline. So here we have two before photographs of the interiors at number one, Kensington Palace Gardens, which was a very large Italianate mansion inherited by a very left-wing MP called George Russell Strauss from his metal merchant father in the early 1930s. And he got married in 1932, and he commissioned Coates to redesign the interiors on modern line. And what better exemplification of those Kaesling notions than this was the what becomes a ballroom, and here on your right is what becomes a drawing room and a dining room. How barbaric indeed is our habit of overloading. And these become, this is just the plan, so you can see, so the ballroom is on the left, there's a central sort of entrance, sort of choreograph in the centre, and on your right are the two main kind of public rooms during the day. There's also a studio, a study for George Russell Strauss here on the bottom left. And this becomes a very quietly choreographed series of spaces where, depending on how important you are, you kind of progress through different spaces within the house. So here, we're here. This is the space looking through to the staircases encased in plywood. So you kind of come in through the entrance. You come into one space, then you come to another, and then if you're really lucky, you get into the entrance hall. But just as a prelude to that, there's a kind of silent, quiet space for contemplation, which is almost completely empty, except for this little feature space, and a tokonoma is a recess or a shelf or a space within a Japanese interior where there's usually placed just one sort of beautiful object for contemplation. So in Crusade, if we think of that Crusade interior, you have a little shelf with this artfully arranged scarf for contemplation. It's a shame the rather large radiator has to be in the way, but overlook that. And here you have sort of set piece, this wonderful chrome steel table with a, I think it's sort of pinkish glass top, this wonderfully huge mirror behind it, so reflecting the new staircase, and then this beautifully arranged flower piece, a little bit of nature within actually what is quite synthetic environment. And Coates very rarely uses sort of supernatural materials. Just, you know, that, there's always some foliage somewhere, but these materials are modern manufactured materials. Before and after the dining room, in its late 1890s splendour, just makes you want to scratch yourself, I would think. And then calm, quiet, sober, classical interior. You thought, oh dear, that's not good. I had to speed up. It transformed into this very quiet interior. So very quiet colours, the creams, very beige carpet, and I don't know if you can see terribly well on this image, but Coates' sort of favourite device are shoji-like screens to cover the windows and to allow the light to be more manipulated. So these are screens, and he writes to his mother in that letter of 1930 asking for details about the dimensions of shoji screens, how they're made, and how so he can do them, if you like, properly. So these are bay windows originally, which have these screens built over them with shangtung silk stretched between them. It's also worth noting that the Sopwith camels that he flies have a similar technology of frame with fabric stretched tightly over them. So there's all these overlaps constantly throughout his career. And the screens that you can slide back and forth, so for more or less light. So the idea, I think, of a room designed around the needs of the people who use them. This is not about display, which I think this interior is about. This is a room for when you have lots of servants. This is a streamlined space which allows you to eat efficiently and relax efficiently. And I just put the plan in because of the palace, because it struck me in a very, very surface kind of way that the table in the middle is not unlike the interior of the Crown Prince's palace. And again, it's just a very calm, quiet setting for the couple as they start their married life. Everything serves their needs. It's not imposing on them. And then, of course, Lawnmower Flats. People were tweeting that I was going to talk about this. I thought, well, I wasn't going to, but I better had, because people would be expecting me to talk about. This is the project that really is Coates' longest project. He starts working on it towards the end of 29. He meets Jack Pritchard around that date, and he works with Jack and Molly to develop a new form of urban living on a site at Belsize Park. It's originally going to be a house, then it becomes a house for Coates and Marion and Jack and Molly, and then Rosemary Molly Pritchard says, well, actually, we've got a site in the middle of an urban area. It's kind of immoral to just have a house on it, or two houses. I think we should be a bit more ambitious. So it ends up being, as you'll know, a block of very tightly designed, minimal dwellings for modern urban professionals who are pretty much kind of overlooked by the contemporary housing market. Built from this wonderful cast concrete frame, expressed with these wonderfully cantilevered balconies, quite a simple design, but beautifully done. But I think in particular, this is where Coates kind of takes that idea that he identifies in the Japanese room, and this is, you know, this is one room living, as somewhere where at the end of the hurly-burly of a business day, you can come back to your room and have quiet, and you have an environment which is completely designed around you to enable you to live efficiently And well, these are tiny. These are 15 feet by 12 feet is the main living space. And then you have this sort of strip of kitchen, dressing room and bathroom alongside. All the furniture is built in, so you have a kind of sufficient space to live your life. You've got your little living area, this is your bed, which is a divan, so it becomes a sort of settee during the day. You've got your built-in furniture with a heater, come cocktail cabinet at the end. What a brilliant idea, warm cocktails at the end of the day. And then you've got your dining area, sliding doors again on the kind of Japanese model, so you don't have casement doors, which are going to be fired by Japan. I think very often his clients shared that sensibility too. And we met Coates and Manchester back in their most their boho avant-garde days when they were getting up to no manner of naughty things. And when Elsa Lanchester kind of comes good and she marries Tos Lawton in 1929 and they kind of become a sort of power couple, go off to Hollywood, and then in 1933 Charles Lawton is part of the team who do the season at the Old Vic for 1933-34 under the direction of Tyrone Guthrie. And they decide to settle in London, and Elsa Lanchester finds them the top stories of a house at 34 Gordon Square, what's now the Institute of Archaeology of the University College London, and they commission their old friend Coates to design the interior. And Coates seems to have worked quite closely with both of them, but particularly with Charles Lawton, who collected art and who had a great interest in Japanese ceramics, and who's a close friend of Bernard Leach, and collected Bernard Leach's ceramics as well. And their sort of joint sensibility seems to have created another set of interiors which were about taking those Japanese principles of the room as setting, the room as quiet and calm, and marrying those again, as you can see, with particular motifs, particularly the shoji screens, which are used quite extensively in the interior to open up and close off space. So they have a whole kind of three floors of a Georgian house, and the main floor, the first floor, is where they have a living room and a dining room and a drawing room as well. And here we can see them posed artfully by the shoji screen, but I think also then that idea of a relatively simple interior, a plain interior, getting rid of all the clutter, all the overcrowding, and just having the essentials of life, and having furniture as itself as a setting for certain types of things. And Constance Spry was a very close friend of Lanchester and Lawton, and she taught Lawton how to flower arrange. And these were all his flower arrangements, but he refused to let anyone know that he did the flower arranging, so they had to pretend that Elsa Lanchester did it, even though she's probably like me and kills all living things. But again, you've got that idea of nature kind of constrained and controlled and given a very artful, contemplative setting. And I think Elsa Lanchester describes the process of setting up home and the design of the interior in a book she publishes in 1938, called Charles Lawton and I. It's a very interesting book, and I think her comment really sums up how kind of odd these kind of interiors were, with their aesthetic quietness, their sobriety, and the idea that really they were a backdrop, which is, you know, given that they are theatrical people, is even more appropriate. Back to their lives. And she sort of said, you know, people thought it was unfurnished, you know, we meant it to be unfurnished, but people thought we hadn't quite finished doing it, but we had, and we liked it. And I just, you know, I'm also thinking how the screen acts as a bit like a sort of stage curtain. You can imagine them kind of leaping out ready to entertain Marlene Dietrich, who often came for dinner. I guess the kind of most Japanese of Coates's designs in before the war was this one, which the exterior mostly still exists. It's been rebuilt at the top. The interior is no longer there. And this is his own home at 18 Yeoman's Row. So he split up from his wife Marion during the course of 1935, and he found a studio flat in just round the corner from the Questor store and near Brompton Oratory. And we got a blue plaque for Coates in November last year, which was unveiled by his grandchildren Susie and Matt and his niece Sylvia. It was a wonderful day. And Yeoman's Row became his studio and home, and he later had a studio downstairs as well. And this was a very personal kind of environment for Coates as a kind of man reinventing himself again as a kind of single male on the prowl, but as a kind of setting for the way he wanted to live his life. And he, again, I think he takes that those principles of an efficient, livable space and weaves magic in an interior which is really, really small. We got a chance to go into the house on the day of the unveiling, and it really is a very small interior. It's about 12 foot in height. And into that space, you come up the back here, and you kind of come in through here, and you've basically got a room in front of you. It's really very small indeed. And he packs this wonderful kind of compact home. It's like a sort of slightly stretched Lawn Road single flat. So on either side of a kind of entrance where you have a little kitchen and a bathroom, and then another little space for his daughter's bedroom and a bathroom, and then his own bedroom, you can probably see best in this section here, is reached, it's stuck into a sort of mezzanine space and reached by a little staircase, which I always imagine can't have been much fun if you'd even only had like one gin. I would have thought that was a pretty precarious route to your bed, though I imagine you maybe kind of your memory does it for you after a while. But the main feature of it is, so you had this one big, well, not very big space at all. This is the window front here, and this is sort of vivarium where he has cactuses and various sort of plants and things, so sort of captured nature. Again, the living space here. This is where he does his typing. You see the arrows on the plan, so his little typing desk sits back flush with the built-in shelving along here and becomes a kind of buffet surface when he has parties. But the main feature is this sort of relaxation space. This is where the kind of social life of the interior takes place. And it's bound by this plywood bookshelves here, and these little knobs here are for angle poise lamps, which haven't been put in yet. And they can turn around to light the space this way, or this little space here, which he calls his hearth scene à la japonais. And here on these tatami mats, and this is something he only uses in this design, you could sit around, you could lean against the wall of the bookcase with your light overlooking, you could read, you could chat. You've got this is his stereo system here, or pre-stereo record player. You can there's a swivel shelf that moves either way to get a tray out, depending on what side you are, to pick up your drinks. This is a kind of little nook and cranny for Coates and his mates at the end of the day. And apparently he would squat here quite happily, again, à la japonais, while all his English friends sort of felt uncomfortable, and both sort of socially and physically, while their master was at ease. And here he is in a photograph by Howard Costa at his writing desk. So we can see the end of the hearth scene just here, and the vivarium behind him. And I thought I'd finish with this image because I think it represents the point at which the sort of synthesis, this dovetailing between the Japanese and the Western really, I think, reached its peak. And I think the kind of assuredness of the architecture which we see here, and I've shown you just some interiors this evening, and the kind of other buildings which he continued to design towards the end of the 30s, particularly Palace Gate, which is a wonderful, quite complex 3-2 section design near Hyde Park, gives him a kind of place within the English modern movement, which I think assures his authority and his leadership of that movement. I think, again, that's very much to do with this sense of being an outsider and having to make a place for yourself within an environment. And the kind of conversion to architecture, I think, gives him the zeal to take on what is essentially, you know, you're taking on the establishment of the architectural profession and trying to make it do something else. And it's because of that that Coates is invited in 1932 to form the English branch of the what's called SIAM, the International Congress of Modern Architecture, which has been formed in Switzerland in 1928 and is the international gathering ground for modernist architects. And that's called the Modern Architectural Research Group, the MARS Group. And the MARS bar is invented in the same decade. Don't know which came first. And the MARS Group certainly becomes a very important gathering point for modernists in Britain in the 30s. And after the war, it becomes very much the focus for the rethinking of modernism more generally across Europe. So it's an incredibly important group. So he really does go from Japan to Mars by 1939. But what's interesting is that after 1939, this Japanese narrative in his work really diminishes. During the war, Coates doesn't talk about it very much at all. It's his technical prowess that he emphasises because he wants to be part of the war effort and he will become part of the RAF again and work on bomber plane designs and later on prefab designs, taking some of the aerial technologies to the domestic setting. After the war, because he wants to resume his place as the leader of the British modernists, he emphasises his pioneer work in the 30s. When that doesn't really have much success, he goes back to his native Canada, where he seeks to again lead what is an emerging Canadian modernist culture. And in that context, again, he doesn't mention his Japanese-ness. He mentions his Canadian genealogy, and he goes on and on and on about how old his mother's family are in a Canadian context, how early they came to the colony, and how Canadian, and indeed white Canadian, that he and his family are. Nevertheless, I hope I've shown you that for that decade or so between 1929 and the outbreak of war in 1939, his dovetailing of East and West produced, I think, a blueprint for a modern architecture that would be equally influential and inspirational on subsequent generations. So I may leave it there, and thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.